Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. We're celebrating six of our listeners who have birthdays today. John Bates of Cedar Rapids, happy birthday to you. Gerald Kasky of Marshalltown, it's your birthday. We hope you have a wonderful day. Sean Gibson of West Des Moines, happy birthday to you and many happy returns. Leon Maxson of Stewart, we're sending you our best wishes for a happy, happy birthday. Kristen Michelson of Edgewood, happy birthday and many happy returns. Marlene Sigworth of Marion, we are sending you warm birthday wishes as well. If today is also your birthday and your name wasn't read with John's, Gerald's, Sean's, Leon's, Kristen's, and Marlene's, please give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to today's USA Today. We'll begin with five things that the editors say we need to know this Monday, September 28th, 2020. First, Trump taxes. Questions continue after New York Times report. Questions are continuing to be asked Monday after President Donald Trump refused to discuss his tax returns after a report said he paid only $750 in personal federal income taxes in 2016 and 2017, and he paid no income taxes at all in 10 of the previous 15 years. Trump on Sunday dismissed a New York Times investigation into his tax records, which revealed a string of financial losses that helped him avoid paying taxes and showed the president is beset by hundreds of millions in personal debt that will come due within the next 4 years. The analysis also found Trump earned millions abroad after he took office, raising questions about whether it conflicts with his role as president. The president dismissed the story Sunday during a news conference, calling the reporting, quote, totally fake news, end quote. Trump was the first major presidential candidate in 4 decades to refuse to release tax returns and has long used the excuse that he cannot reveal them due to an audit by the Internal Revenue Service. However, an audit does not prevent Trump from releasing his records. Second, heat wave brings critical risks of wildfires to California. California residents are bracing for another wave of wildfires as the state is exposed to, quote, critical risks for fire weather on Monday. The state's biggest utility, PG&E, said it planned to cut off power to 89,000 customers Sunday through Monday morning, mostly in the northern and central Sierra, but also extending to parts of the San Francisco Bay Area as a preventive measure to avoid igniting fires. The number of affected customers was later reduced to 65,000. A new fire erupted early Sunday in the Napa Valley wine country north of San Francisco, quickly burning through 1,000 acres and forcing officials to order mandatory evacuations. Third, deadline arrives for Trump administration to stop holding immigrant children in hotels. Hundreds, possibly thousands, of immigrant children are being held in hotels in several cities for prolonged periods of time under secretive emergency measures that quickly expel undocumented immigrants who arrive at the border during the pandemic. A federal judge last week gave the Trump administration until Monday to put an end to the practice. U.S. District Judge Dolly Gee ruled September 4th that the government's detention of children longer than 72 hours violated a settlement that governs the treatment of immigrant children in custody, and previously ordered the Trump administration to stop holding the children in hotels as part of the policy by September 15th. But the practice has continued while the Trump administration sought stays pending an appeal. Fourth, Tampa Bay looks to beat Dallas and lift the Stanley Cup. The Tampa Bay Lightning will try again Monday to finish off the Dallas Stars as the two teams meet in Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals at 8 p.m. Eastern on NBC. The Lightning lead the Stars in the best-of-seven series 3-2. The Stars stayed alive in Game 5 Saturday in a come-from-behind double overtime victory. Center Joe Pavelski tied the game in the third period with a power play goal, and Corey Perry sealed the 3-2 win with his second goal of the game. Interesting stat, the Lightning are 6-0 in the postseason after a loss. And finally, Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, ends. Yom Kippur, which is observed from sundown Sunday to sundown Monday, is considered the holiest day of the year in Judaism. It's a high holiday that follows Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Yom Kippur translates from Hebrew to English as Day of Atonement. Traditionally, Jews spend the holiday fasting and reflecting on sins committed over the past year. According to Jewish tradition, one's fate is decided on Rosh Hashanah and sealed on Yom Kippur. People who observe Yom Kippur neither eat nor drink for 25 hours, with the exception of children and those for whom fasting is dangerous. Once the period of fasting ends, it's time to break the fast with bagels and egg dishes. In today's coronavirus updates compiled by John Bacon and Joel Shannon of USA Today, in Minnesota, an ambitious effort to learn more about the spread of COVID-19 has been shut down amid claims of harassment and ethnic slurs, while the latest effort in North Carolina to make voting easier during the pandemic is facing a court challenge. The Re-Election Committee of President Donald Trump is among groups that have filed suit, claiming North Carolina's new rules allowing mail-in absentee ballots with deficient information to be fixed without need for a new ballot, quote, undermine protections, end quote, that make voting safe in the state. North Carolina and other states expect a major surge in absentee voting for the November 3rd election amid the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 1 million voters in North Carolina already have requested an absentee ballot. In today's numbers, the U.S. has reported more than 7.1 million cases and 204,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University data. Globally, there have been almost 33 million cases and nearly 1 million fatalities. New York City doesn't have enough teachers for classes this week. The leader of the New York City Union, representing its principals, on Sunday urged the state to take control of the school system from Mayor Bill de Blasio. Mark Cannizzaro, president of the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators, expressed concern with the mayor's plan under which most of the city's 1.1 million students would begin reporting to classrooms this week. Cannizzaro told the New York Times the city doesn't have enough teachers to staff schools, but he also said principals have no plans to strike. Quote, I think parents should be confident that any child that arrives at a building will be given the utmost care, Cannizzaro said. The union's executive board cast a unanimous vote of no confidence. City officials said plans for elementary school students to return to classes Tuesday and middle and high schoolers to go back Thursday remain in place. Israeli leader asks that government be forgiven, quote, for not doing enough, end quote. Israel was marking Yom Kippur among the most holy of Jewish holidays on Sunday evening in virtual lockdown amid a spike in COVID-19 cases among the worst in the world. The nation of 9 million people is struggling with about 7,000 new cases daily, stressing the hospital system. A lockdown in the spring dropped new cases to a handful per day. But schools and businesses reopened and the outbreak raced out of control. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin now has called on people to light a candle in memory of the more than 1,400 Israelis who have died. Quote, they were all loved, all known, all had names and faces, he said. Quote, may we be forgiven for the sin of weakness and inability, for not doing enough, for not managing to save them. Because of that, lives were lost, end quote. And according to the WHO, people will probably start getting vaccinated in mid-2021. Mass vaccinations for COVID-19 aren't likely before next summer, World Health Organization Chief Scientist Soumya Swaminathan said Sunday. Swaminathan said the ideal vaccine would protect at least 70% of those who are vaccinated, but that a minimum standard is 50%. The ideal vaccine would require only one shot and last for several years, she said. Most of what she said parallels predictions made by Dr. Anthony Fauci and other top U.S. experts. Quote, by the time people start getting the vaccine, it will be somewhere in the middle of 2021, she said. And workers back at jobs as Melbourne, Australia relaxes restrictions. More than 125,000 workers will be able to return to their jobs Monday as Melbourne, Australia's second largest city, relaxes lockdown restrictions imposed in early August after a surge in coronavirus cases. Elementary school children will be allowed back in the classrooms the week of October 12th. Melbourne and surrounding parts of rural Victoria State were placed under strict so-called Level 4 lockdowns on August 2nd, closing schools and non-essential businesses, imposing a nighttime curfew, and prohibiting public gatherings. Some of those restrictions were lifted Sunday, but gatherings will be severely limited, even those held outdoors for religious purposes, and fines for those breaking the rules will be increased to nearly $5,000, Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews said. On the front page of today's USA Today, Richard Wolff reports how court would shift with Amy Coney Barrett. If President Donald Trump and Senate Republicans succeed in putting Federal Appeals Court Judge Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court, it will mark the biggest change there since 1991. It was then that Associate Justice Thurgood Marshall, a liberal giant of the civil rights movement, retired in failing health and was replaced by Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, who has become the most conservative member of the court. Twice more since then, personnel changes moved the court to the right. In 2006, when Associate Justice Samuel Alito took over for Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and 2018, when Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh succeeded Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy. O'Connor and Kennedy were moderates named by Republican presidents, so the difference was not as dramatic. Here are 10 ways the court could be altered if Barrett replaces Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was the leader of the court's liberal wing. Abortion. Ginsburg was a firm supporter of reproductive rights, voting to block laws in Texas and Louisiana that would have imposed restrictions on abortion clinics, forcing many to close. Barrett's most vocal proponents are in the anti-abortion movement. In one case, she would have allowed Indiana to try again to win court approval of a law banning abortions based on sex, gender, or disability. Healthcare. The Affordable Care Act twice has been upheld by the Supreme Court, thanks mostly to Chief Justice John Roberts siding with the liberal wing. A third major case will be heard in November. Barrett criticized Roberts' opinion in concluding the law is constitutional because its penalty for not purchasing insurance, since reduced to zero, can be categorized as a tax. Guns. The Supreme Court has not expanded the right to keep guns at home for self-defense since its landmark rulings in 2008 and 2010, most recently jettisoning a New York City case and refusing to hear several others. Barrett dissented when the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit restricted the Second Amendment rights of a nonviolent felon. Religious liberty. The High Court looks favorably on religious liberty claims, and Barrett's confirmation might make that a lock. The court said last term that states may not discriminate against religious schools in scholarship programs open to private school students and let employers with religious objections sidestep rules designed to provide insurance coverage for contraceptives. Next term, it will hear a case about a Catholic agency that refuses to place foster children with same-sex couples. LGBTQ rights. The Supreme Court ruled in June that gay, lesbian, and transgender workers are covered under a federal employment law that prohibits sex discrimination. Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. Barrett has spoken and written about her personal belief that marriage is between a man and a woman, though she said it would not influence her rulings from the bench. Chief Justice John Roberts. The Roberts Court since 2005 has been one in which the Chief Justice played a vastly influential role. For the past 2 years since Kennedy's retirement, he has been the swing vote. A court with six conservatives would deprive Roberts of that role and strengthen the hand of the court's most conservative justices, Thomas and Associate Justice Samuel Alito. Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. Would Trump's first two new nominees be the new swing votes? Kavanaugh has sided with Roberts more than any other justice and takes the consequences of potential court rulings into consideration. Gorsuch has a libertarian streak that places him with the liberal wing on occasion. He wrote the court's decision last term extending a federal employment protection law to LGBTQ workers. The liberal wing. Ginsburg was the senior member of the liberal wing since 2010 when Associate Justice John Paul Stevens retired. A 6-3 court would give that role to Associate Justice Stephen Breyer, who at 82 is the oldest justice. Associate Justice Elena Kagan, President Barack Obama's second nominee, is a strategic thinker and bridge builder who could play an outsized role. Public opinion. In recent years, the Supreme Court has been the most popular branch of the federal government. In a poll last week by Marquette Law School, 59% say they trust the court the most among the three branches, compared with 24% for the presidency and 16% for Congress. A deeply partisan confirmation battle that could turn a seat from liberal to conservative on the eve of an election is bound to change that. And finally, structural changes. In the never-ending partisan war over judicial nominations, both Democrats and Republicans have changed the rules when they were in power. If Republicans muscle through the battle and win a 6-3 court majority but lose the White House and Senate in November's election, Democrats could seek to add justices to the high court, impose term limits, or further limit Senate minority rights. Also on the front page of today's USA Today, Kenny Jacoby and Jessica Priest report, defense laws protect officers. The lack of criminal charges against Kentucky police officers for the shooting death of Breonna Taylor stems not from a unique quirk in that state's law, but from deeply embedded protections in the U.S. legal system for those who use deadly force to protect themselves. Those protections mean law enforcement officers and civilians alike have been deemed justified in accidentally killing or injuring innocent bystanders in the course of self-defense. In 2018, a San Antonio police officer responding to a report of an assault fatally shot one man when he meant to shoot another, grabbing for a gun. In 2017, a Philadelphia laundromat owner shot a bystander twice in the hand while firing on a fleeing man who'd stolen $2,000 from his store. In 2015, a Utah police officer shot and injured a man resembling a suspect who had fired a gun at him. None was charged with a crime. Quote, you've got to have intent, and with Breonna Taylor, he, the officer, didn't intend to kill her. The officer returned fire and happened to get Breonna, said Scott Boudreau, a Birmingham, Alabama defense attorney who has represented clients in accidental killings. Quote, I think it's self-defense, end quote. In the early hours of March 13th, Taylor's boyfriend shot one of the three plainclothes officers. He said he mistook them for intruders when they broke down the door to her apartment, serving a search warrant for narcotics. Police said they identified themselves before entering the home. They returned fire and hit Taylor, who died in her apartment hallway. No drugs were found. Wednesday, a grand jury indicted one of the three officers, Brett Hankison, on charges of wanton endangerment of Taylor's neighbors, not Taylor herself, as a result of firing his weapon into a nearby apartment. It declined to indict any of the officers for reckless homicide. Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron cautioned against a so-called quest for revenge, which did little to quell unrest after the grand jury decision. Protests erupted across the country. Quote, if Brett Hankinson's behavior was wanton endangerment to people in neighboring apartments, then it should have been wanton endangerment in Breonna Taylor's apartment, too, Ben Crump, an attorney for Taylor's family, wrote on Twitter. The way the officers carried out the no-knock search warrant after midnight should be reviewed, said Dave Laban, president of the National Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. Crump suggested the officers knowingly used false information to obtain the warrant. If that can be proved, the dynamic of the case against the officers could change and more charges could be brought. The officers entered Taylor's apartment legally, were shot at first, and had a right to defend themselves, Laban said, calling the situation, quote, lawful but awful, end quote. What Cameron described as, quote, vigorous, end quote, self-defense laws in the state are part of a much broader trend in America toward forgiving people who claim self-defense. Many U.S. states have statutes codifying the Castle Doctrine, which stems from an English court case finding in 1604 that a man has no duty to retreat from an assailant in his own dwelling because, quote, a man's home is his castle, end quote. More than half of U.S. states, including Kentucky, expanded on this concept by enacting so-called stand-your-ground laws, which remove the duty to retreat for people attacked outside their homes, so long as they are in a place they have a right to be, aren't committing a crime, and didn't provoke the confrontation. In Taylor's case, Laban said, Kenneth Walker, Taylor's boyfriend, was justified in shooting at the officers, and they were justified in shooting back. A, quote, true man, end quote, fights back. After American colonies gained their independence from the British, the new states largely imported common law from England to use as judicial precedent for their own courts. In England, the law recognized very few civilian homicide defenses as valid. English law forbade homicide except as a last resort, requiring those under attack to first flee the scene or retreat as far away as possible. Only then, with a wall at their back and nowhere else to go, did the state authorize them to kill their assailants. Even then, it was the killer's burden to prove that using lethal force was necessary to save themselves from grievous harm. England's duty to retreat was a, quote, powerful means to produce a society of civility, wrote Richard Maxwell Brown in his 1991 book, No Duty to Retreat, Violence and Values in American History and Society. Boiled down, it was a command to avoid physical conflicts, Brown wrote, barring fatal outcomes in most disputes and resulting in relatively low homicide rates. Americans abandoned the English standard and adopted a fundamentally different attitude toward self-defense, primarily fueled by two state court decisions in the post-Reconstruction era. In Ohio in 1876, the Supreme Court reversed the conviction of a man who shot and killed his son-in-law. The man said the son-in-law charged at him with an axe. The court found that the man was not at fault for provoking the confrontation and had acted as a, quote, true man, end quote, free to defend himself against his assailant. The following year, the Supreme Court in Indiana took it a step further, ruling that a man who shot and killed an unarmed man in a riot on Election Day was justified because the unarmed man had instigated a fistfight with him. Overturning the man's conviction, Judge William Niblack wrote that, quote, the tendency of the American mind seems to be very strongly against the enforcement of any rule which requires a person to flee when assailed, end quote. In light of these decisions, courts across the USA began to broadly accept the view that fleeing amounted to cowardice and that cowardice was un-American, Brown wrote in his book. In the early 1900s, a Minnesota judge rejected the duty to retreat, saying it was an outdated law that did not take into account the influx of guns into societal life. Wisconsin's Supreme Court the same year asserted man's so-called divine right to, quote, stand his ground, end quote. Some states, including Florida, have gone so far as shifting the burden onto prosecutors to prove a homicide was not committed in self-defense. Such laws, quote, benefit the defendant in a phenomenal way, end quote, and make prosecutors less likely to file homicide charges, especially in cases with no witnesses, said Dennis DeVlaming, a criminal defense attorney in Clearwater. Quote, prosecutors hate this new law, DeVlaming said. Quote, unless they can disprove the defendant's version of events, either forensically or by a statement or contradiction, he gets a pass, end quote. Laws especially protect police. In 2017, Birmingham, Alabama resident Daryl Hutton shot at a man who pulled a gun on him, and one of the bullets struck and killed a 4-year-old girl. He was charged with murder. Boudreau represented Hutton and asked the judge for a hearing to consider whether Alabama's so-called stand your ground law applied. He argued that Hutton was defending himself and didn't intend to kill the girl. A judge agreed, dismissing the charges. Law enforcement officers rarely face criminal charges or convictions as a result of fatal shootings because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1989 that their actions must be evaluated based on what a reasonable officer would do, given what was known at the time. Because this is a hard concept for jurors to wrap their minds around, prosecutors often choose not to charge officers, said Philip Stinson, a criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Quote, the role of a prosecutor is to seek justice, but as a practical matter, they're very concerned with whether they can obtain a conviction, he said. Even when fellow officers testify that they didn't feel afraid, calling the accused officer's reason into question, jurors defer to how the accused officer felt in the moment. Quote, jurors are very reluctant to second-guess the split-second life-or-death decisions of a police officer in a potentially violent encounter, Stinson said. Stinson found that since 2005, 121 officers have been charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting in the USA. Of them, 44 were convicted, most for a lesser offense, such as official misconduct, deprivation of civil rights, aggravated assault, or reckless discharge of a firearm. Of the 7 convicted of murder, 4 of the convictions were overturned. According to the Washington Post, police fatally shot nearly 1,000 people in 2019. That 1989 Supreme Court ruling, Graham v. O'Connor, was about officers using excessive force, not self-defense. Laban said there are questions about whether defense laws should be written as they are and whether no-knock warrants should be used the way the Louisville officers did. Quote, "This is why we have legislatures," Laban said. "Unfortunately, with many things in criminal justice, it takes bad results for people to pay attention." End quote. David Jackson and Courtney Subramanian report, Trump paid $750 in personal income taxes. President Donald Trump denied a news report Sunday that he paid only $750 in personal federal income taxes in 2016 and 2017, but did not provide evidence and again refused to release his tax returns. Trump told reporters at the White House that, quote, "actually, I paid tax," end quote, but said he would not release returns on his own because they are under U.S. IRS audit, an excuse he has used for years. Quote, "I paid a lot, and I paid a lot of state income taxes, too," Trump said. "New York State charges a lot, and I paid a lot of money in state," end quote. The New York Times reported Sunday that Trump paid $750 in federal income taxes in 2016, the year he won the presidency, and another $750 in 2017, his first year in office. The Times said Trump paid no income taxes in 10 of the previous 15 years, quote, "largely because he reported losing much more money than he made," end quote. The Times said his report to the IRS, quote, "portray a businessman who takes in hundreds of millions of dollars a year, yet racks up chronic losses that he aggressively employs to avoid paying taxes," end quote. Trump has refused to release tax returns. He is embroiled in a battle with New York prosecutors over his records. The Times said it plans to publish additional stories based on the trove of data it obtained. The Times said it obtained the records from sources with legal access to them. Democrats quickly questioned the legality of Trump's tax maneuvers. Quote, "This may be why @real Donald Trump has potential legal problems," tweeted Democratic strategist David Axelrod. Quote, "If you claim massive losses to avoid paying federal income taxes, but inflate your revenues and assets on bank documents for loan purposes, wouldn't that constitute fraud?" End quote. The president called the story, quote, "fake news," end quote, and said details about his taxes would, quote, "all be revealed," end quote. Alan Garten, a lawyer from the Trump Organization, told The Times that over the past decade, Trump has paid, quote, "tens of millions of dollars in personal taxes to the federal government," end quote. Adriana Rodriguez of USA Today reports, a drone carrying a human kidney flew over the Las Vegas desert. Experts say it's the future of organ transportation. Drones are used today for a variety of tasks, delivering small express packages, assisting in search and rescue operations, capturing stunning aerial views, to name just a few. Get ready to add one more to the growing list: human organ transit. Researchers at Mission Go, a provider of unmanned aviation solutions, and the Nevada Donor Network, an organ procurement organization, announced last week two successful test flights carrying a human organ and tissue via drones in Las Vegas. The first flight on September 17th transported research corneas from one hospital to another about 2.5 miles away. On the same day, a second flight delivered research kidneys 10 miles from an airport to a location outside of a small town in the Las Vegas desert. It marked the longest organ delivery flight in drone history, surpassing the distance of a historic April 2019 flight when the Mission Go team transported a kidney from the University of Maryland campus to its medical center in Baltimore and successfully transplanted it into a patient. Organs are normally transported via commercial aircrafts, but the coronavirus pandemic has drastically reduced the number of flights available. Both United Airlines and American Airlines have slashed the number of their September flights nearly in half, while Southwest Airlines has cut 25%. While Joe Ferreira, CEO and president of the Nevada Donor Program, says hundreds of flights are still needed to test the reliability and safety of drone delivery, he's optimistic the technology could be the future of organ transportation. Quote, "Our ecosystem is a complex one. There's a number of things you have to prove to be able to ensure that it's safe, effective, and reliable," Ferreira said. Quote, "We're in the beginning stages of providing this mode of transport on behalf of the heroic donors and their courageous families," end quote. All right, and at just past 1:30 the hour, it's time for us to turn to the opinion page of today's Des Moines Register. At the top of the page is a Your Turn guest column written by Himar Hernandez, who is a community worker with Iowa State University. His column is titled, "Iowa's Latinos Must Get Serious About Voting." When I first left my home in the Canary Islands and came to Iowa back in 1993, I was the only Hispanic kid in Ottumwa High School. These days, things look very different. Latinos make up about a third of the student body, and immigrants like me are a vital part of our increasingly diverse and vibrant community. After attracting an influx of Latino workers in the late 1990s, Ottumwa was able to keep our meatpacking plant and even expand operations, creating jobs and vital tax revenues that have kept our community alive. Perhaps because of that, our city has been remarkably welcoming to Latinos and immigrants. But as much as Latinos love our community, we aren't participating fully in the democratic process. This November, far too few of us will cast ballots and help choose our local and national leaders. That's a problem. We need immigration policies that welcome immigrant talent and domestic policies that support our nation's diversity. Nationally, Latinos make up 13% of eligible voters, up from just 9% in the 2008 election. In total, there are 32 million Hispanics who are eligible to vote in this year's election, making us the single biggest racial or ethnic minority voting bloc. But there's a catch. In every presidential race since 1996, fewer than half of eligible Latino voters have actually gone out and cast ballots. The same is also true of immigrants more generally. According to New American Economy, Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Ottumwa, has 12,775 eligible immigrant voters, but only 6,726 of us have actually registered to vote. That needs to change, not just because it could affect election results, but because voting is a vital part of what makes us all Americans. I started Ottumwa's first citizenship classes back in 2004, and since then, I've helped hundreds of immigrants to learn about American history and values, pass their citizenship interviews, and proudly take their oath to defend our Constitution. After I attend a citizenship ceremony, I always offer to walk these new members of our American family across the street to the courthouse so they can register to vote. After all, your vote is your voice, and if you don't speak up about the things that matter to you, someone else will speak instead. Here in Iowa, we've seen what happens when minority communities like ours get excluded from the political process. Back in 2002, the Iowa English Language Reaffirmation Act made it difficult for the government to provide vital services, including ballots and voter registration forms, in languages other than English, an unnecessary barrier that felt like a slap in the face to many immigrant and Latino communities. Similar things are still happening today. Across the country, voter ID laws, voter roll purges, and reduced access to polling stations are disproportionately hurting Latino and minority voters. We can only push back against these exclusionary policies if we elect leaders who appreciate the value and beauty of diverse, energetic communities like ours. That means registering to vote, making a plan for how and when we'll cast our ballots, and helping our friends, family, and neighbors to do the same. So take a few minutes now and visit the Iowa Secretary of State's website, sos.iowa.gov, to check whether you're registered to vote, to get registered if you aren't already, and to find out how to cast an absentee ballot or vote in person this November 3rd. Iowa's Hispanic Americans and naturalized immigrants must take the next big step toward full integration. Register to vote and participate in the American democratic process this year. Your voice matters, but only if you use it. Again, this was a guest column written by Himar Hernandez, a community worker with Iowa State University. In today's letters to the editor, Fred Dorr of Urbandale writes, Biden, like so many, avoided the draft too. In the heat of a presidential election year, candidates' military records inevitably arise. Donald Trump's avoidance of the draft during the Vietnam era is well documented. Joe Biden's, not so much. He also avoided the draft during that same period, obtaining 5 draft deferments while in college and upon graduation, avoided military service through receipt of a 1Y disqualification due to asthma as a teenager. That despite his playing football in high school, working a summer job as a lifeguard, and actively playing sports while in college. The truth is that so many of my generation did the exact same thing. If they were connected somehow, they avoided military service, leaving it to the less fortunate to fill their spots. Several recent presidents or aspirants of both major political parties did exactly the same thing. Party affiliation now has little to do with it. Dodging the draft was not a conservative or a liberal thing. many of the present generation of leaders found a way out through joining the service through various means. Joining the military should be an honor, not a burden. Signed, Fred Dorr of Urbandale. John Moore of Newton writes, "Stop complaining, wear a mask." Here we are about 6 months into this pandemic, and people are still complaining about shutdowns, online learning, and scaled back fall sports programs when the solution has been literally in our faces this entire time. Wear a mask. You went to bars and restaurants back in business? Wear a mask. You want kids all back in school? Wear a mask. You want high school and college sports back and fans in the stands? Wear a mask. This stubborn refusal to do the one thing every single medical professional agrees would lessen the severity of this pandemic is a slap in the face to common sense, decency, and Iowa nice. You don't want to play nice. You can stay home so the rest of us can get on with our lives by doing the right thing. Signed, John Moore of Newton. John Rewalt of Huxley writes, "Two wrongs make a right." I have to admit that Senator Grassley is right. He can't be accused of hypocrisy. 4 years ago, if you were paying attention, you knew he was lying when he denied Judge Garland a hearing. Signed, John Rewalt of Huxley. Josiah C. Warren of Hastings writes, "Trump is who we thought he was." Before the 2016 election, several scholars warned that the man who eventually won the White House admired tyrants, encouraged violence against his opponents, advocated restrictions on speech, had no regard for the concept of equality under the law, and had autocratic tendencies. They were exactly correct about the man. Our two Iowa senators who chattered about being fair and judicious inevitably came around to defend our president's crimes and vote against his removal from office. At this point, they remain silent in the face of his brazen attempts to limit voting and sow the seeds of distrust about the election. The hypocrisy of Trump's enablers knows no bounds. I listen with horror as fellow Iowans talk about how there is little choice in the upcoming presidential election. If you think this is a time to vote for a third party or to opt out, you need to think again. Politics aside, Joe Biden is fundamentally decent, and Trump is a jerk. Consider the issue of national security. Last week, 489 retired military leaders, ambassadors, and senior civilian national security officers came out publicly in support of Biden. Consider the trust of our allies. Consider that farmers were used as pawns in the trade war against China. The list is endless. Longtime Republicans, your party has been hijacked. Signed, Josiah C. Warren of Hastings. Today's opinion page also includes a column by syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts, Jr., who was a columnist for the Miami Herald. His column today is titled, "Which of Your Children Would You Lose for $12 Million?" It begins with a quote, "We should never forget that everything Adolf Hitler did in Germany was, quote, legal." End quote. And this is a quote from Martin Luther King. In other words, what is legal is not necessarily what is right. With that in mind, I find myself struggling to imagine what justice for Breonna Taylor would have looked like. After all, last week's refusal by a grand jury to indict the Louisville police officers who killed her in March during a bungled midnight drug raid is likely defensible on narrow legal grounds. When someone shoots at you, as Taylor's boyfriend did, firing a single shot at what he thought were home invaders, you have the right to shoot back. But narrow legalities do not address, much less resolve, the sense of visceral wrong that has made Taylor's death a cause célèbre. They don't confront the apparent failure of police to adequately identify themselves before breaching the door. They don't tell us why there was no ambulance on scene as a standard procedure. They don't explain why officers allowed Taylor to lie mortally wounded for at least 5 minutes without rendering first aid. They don't help us process the fact that this 26-year-old African-American woman was not safe from police overreach in her own home. Most of all, narrow legalities do not give us what we need and seldom receive when police kill unarmed African-Americans: accountability, the assurance that someone will answer for this. In place of that, cities offer money. Breonna Taylor's family settled a civil lawsuit for $12 million. But what is $12 million? Which of your children would you lose for $12 million? There's always a payout, and it always feels more like a consolation prize in lieu of accountability. As expressions of deep regret go, it falls well short. We shot a 12-year-old boy for playing with a toy gun in a public park? Oops, here's $6 million. We shot a teenager who was walking away? Oops, here's $5 million. We broke down Breonna Taylor's door in the mistaken belief she was running a drug house and shot her to death? Oops, will you take a check? As it turns out, the only indictment the grand jury approved was against an officer who fired blindly into the apartment, his bullets going through the wall into the next unit next door. So police must answer for putting holes in a wall, but not a woman. I wish I were shocked. Unfortunately, the cost of evading these reckonings will ultimately not be measured in dollars and cents. In the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson speaks of governments, quote, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, end quote. That consent, however, presupposes that government is answerable to the needs and demands of its people. That's where we are. It's the message of this year of discontent, of armies of disaffected Americans marching. They are withdrawing their consent. A government ignores that at its own peril. Meantime, this young woman's family is richer and irretrievably broken. I do not know what justice for Breonna Taylor would have looked like, but I know it wouldn't look like this. And that was Leonard Pitts Jr.'s column for today. Let's turn now to the opinion page of today's USA Today. Today's debate in USA Today editorial focuses on the Barrett nomination. Our view, Senate hypocrites rush to ram through court pick. To the surprise of virtually no one, President Donald Trump nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett on Saturday to fill the Supreme Court vacancy created by the death of liberal icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg. If the choice announced in the Rose Garden even before Ginsburg's burial was lacking in the reality show suspense that surrounded Trump's two previous picks, the outcome might well be the same. Another conservative justice confirmed on a near party-line vote in the Senate following a contentious confirmation process, this one on the cusp of a presidential election. It is particularly egregious that an institution once known as the world's greatest deliberative body would attempt to rush through a Supreme Court nomination, even as it has been unable to pass another relief bill for the millions of Americans suffering because of the coronavirus pandemic. Supreme Court confirmations typically take time, and for good reason. Justices are arguably the 9 most powerful people in government behind the president. They can serve for the rest of their lives, will never face voters, and routinely rule on deeply personal and immensely political matters. In the upcoming term, the justices are expected to decide once again on the fate of the Affordable Care Act, which is to say the ability of millions of Americans to buy health insurance. Abortion rights could well be on the line in the not-too-distant future. For these reasons, it is important that the Senate asks a number of threshold questions before it even delves into the particulars of Judge Barrett, aged 48, who is serving on the 7th Circuit of a Court of Appeals. First among the questions, is it wise to pursue a heated confirmation fight just 38 days from an election? This is the closest to a U.S. presidential election a nomination has been made. In fact, early voting is already underway. Another question is whether it is possible to do the due diligence on any candidate for the high court, one who could serve for decades at the breakneck speed proposed by Senate Republicans, who are said to be eyeing a late October confirmation vote. Most importantly, is it fair for Republicans to hold open a vacancy for the better part of a year in 2016, when a Democrat was president, citing the pending election as a rationale, and then do a 180-degree turn when a Republican makes a nomination? 4 years ago, Republicans insisted their actions were principled. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said in a USA Today opinion piece that the Senate should hold up action on the nomination of Judge Merrick Garland because, quote, the American people deserve a voice in such a momentous decision, end quote. Never mind that it was 8 months before the election and that Garland had sterling credentials. And Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who was on the Senate Judiciary Committee then and is now its chairman, was even more unequivocal. Quote, I want you to use my words against me, he said. Quote, if there's a Republican president elected in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, quote, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination, end quote. Senator, we're using your words against you. The answer to all of these questions, whether it's wise to have a confirmation battle in the home stretch of a critical election, whether there's enough time before the election to give the choice sufficient scrutiny, and whether Senate Republicans have any high ground to stand on, is no. And again, this was the editorial written by the editors of USA Today. USA Today also includes an opposing view written by Republican Rick Scott, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2018 and is serving his first term representing Florida. His column is titled, Democrats Change Their Tune for Partisan Purposes. With the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we're faced with another political battle over a vacant Supreme Court seat. Unlike 2016, the White House and the Senate are both controlled by Republicans. I believe we have a duty and responsibility to hold hearings and a confirmation vote on President Donald Trump's nominee, Judge Amy Coney Barrett. The Democrats and their allies in the news media are already howling with claims of hypocrisy. But Republicans have consistently noted the difference between 2016 and 2020. In 2016, there was divided government. In 2020, Republicans control the White House and the Senate. The Democrats are essentially claiming that there's no difference between 2016 and 2020. If that's the case, why are they changing their tune? In 2016, Senate Democratic Leader Charles Schumer said, quote, "Every day that goes by without a ninth justice is another day the American people's business is not getting done," end quote. In 2020, Senator Schumer said, quote, "This vacancy should not be filled until we have a new president," end quote. In 2016, Senator Richard Blumenthal said, quote, "There's a duty to fill that vacancy to make the system work," end quote. In 2020, Senator Blumenthal said, quote, "This close to the election, there is no way that the United States Senate can or should act before the voters decide," end quote. In 2016, Senator Amy Klobuchar said, quote, "Eight is not enough on the United States Supreme Court," end quote. In 2020, Senator Klobuchar said that Republicans would face a so-called moral reckoning if they attempted to fill the ninth seat on the Supreme Court. In 2016, Vice President Joe Biden said, quote, "The American people deserve a fully staffed Supreme Court of nine, not one disabled and divided, one that is able to rule on the great issues of the day," end quote. In 2020, Biden said, quote, "Let me be clear, the voters should pick a president, and that president should select a successor to Justice Ginsburg," end quote. In the closing paragraph of former President Barack Obama's 2020 statement, he said unequivocally, quote, "A basic principle of the law and of everyday fairness is that we apply rules with consistency and not based on what's convenient or advantageous in the moment," end quote. He no doubt intended these words to be directed at Republicans, but it's the Democrats whose arguments are dripping with hypocrisy. They're changing their tune for partisan purposes. Elections have consequences. The American people elected President Trump and a Republican Senate knowing full well that multiple seats on the Supreme Court could be at stake. What we're doing is exactly what the voters and the Constitution prescribed. If Senate Democrats don't like that, win more elections. Again, this column was written by Republican Rick Scott of Florida. USA Today also includes an opinion written by Melinda Henneberger, a graduate of Notre Dame, who is an editorial writer and columnist for the Kansas City Star and a member of the USA Today Board of Contributors. Her column is titled, "Steer Clear of People of Praise." All faiths are at least a little weird to those outside of them. Imagine telling someone unfamiliar with Catholicism, quote, "Every chance I get, I eat some bread that I believe is the body of God's only Son, who was executed in Jerusalem under Tiberius," end quote. Totally normal, right? So to all of my friends who think that the religious practice of Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett, who is a member of a charismatic ecumenical community called the People of Praise, ought to bring out the bulldog in Kamala Harris and other Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, I say, dear God, no. First, you cannot fight bigotry with bigotry. Religious intolerance is just as wrong as any other kind of othering. And senators, treating her like the kook she is not is just what the president hopes you will do. Unless you want to star in Trump campaign ads that he'll say prove Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is, quote, against God, end quote, don't even think about it. Yes, women leaders in the People of Praise were until recently referred to as, quote, handmaids, end quote, a biblical reference to Mary, the mother of Jesus. In the Gospel of Luke, when the angel tells her, quote, "You will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus," she responds, quote, "Behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord. May it be done to me according to your word," end quote. But the group was not the inspiration for Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Quote, "What the people in that book are going through is horrible," said Joanna Clark, who runs a People of Praise school in Portland, Oregon, and has known Barrett since college. The group does not require a loyalty oath, arrange marriages, or force women to keep having children. It puts a premium on intellectual life and values education for men, women, and children. Its well-regarded schools are attended by many non-members. Don't be a hypocrite. It does have a view of marriage that I don't share, and you might not either, but that St. Paul certainly did. Parenthetical comment, quote, "As the church is subordinate to Christ," says his letter to the Ephesians, "so wives should be subordinate to their husbands in everything," end quote. Close paren. You know that favorite pro-choice rejoinder, quote, "If you don't like abortion, don't have one"? If referring to your husband at home and speaking in tongues isn't your brand of theological vodka, then don't join the People of Praise or any Pentecostal choice. Church, but don't be the kind of hypocrite who embraces only those differences that line up with your own cultural views. Just as Biden is not coming for your guns or your suburbs, neither is he coming for your religious liberty. But could we please make sure Senator Dianne Feinstein is aware, so she doesn't repeat the folly of her 2017, quote, "Dogma lives loudly within you," end quote, gift to the Republicans at Barrett's confirmation hearing for her appointment to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. I have talked to Republicans who know Barrett personally and love her, and to Democrats who know her and don't. But I give special weight to Notre Dame law professor Mark McKenna, who doesn't think Trump should be able to fill this seat and doesn't agree much with his former colleague Barrett on either politics or legal philosophy. Yet he sees her as brilliant, decent, and operating in good faith. Quote, "Religious attacks are both gross and totally politically misguided," he said. He's right. When Justice Sonia Sotomayor visited Notre Dame 5 years ago, McKenna recalled, she, quote, "spoke movingly about her faith has shaped her as a justice," end quote, and nobody found that suspect. The legal giant whom Barrett will presumably replace, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, drew inspiration from her Jewish faith, too. Why is Barrett's Orthodox Catholicism and membership in a charismatic Christian community any different? Unambiguously conservative. As for the kind of justice Barrett would be, Trump was never going to pick Merrick Garland, President Barack Obama's moderate choice to fill Justice Antonin Scalia's seat 4 years ago. Barrett is unambiguously conservative and does seem to think that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. If the end game in choosing a justice is who can get us the results we want, McKenna said, quote, then we don't have a rule of law anymore, end quote. That's exactly how Trump has said he looks at the court. It's not, however, how the High Court was ever supposed to function. Those who know Barrett see her as someone with a far less partisan view of the court's role and hers. Trump is so overtly transactional that he says out loud he has to seat his nominee before Election Day so that the person he picks can in turn pick him after he disputes the voting results. But in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court had to look at counting ballots in a way Florida law hadn't contemplated. That's not going to be the case in 2020. I can't help wondering whether Barrett, who doesn't curse or enjoy hearing others do so, is really a fan of our pea-grabbing, soldier-mocking, handicap-denigrating president. Nobody tell him, but I don't think she's the political hack he's hoping for. By all means, Democrats, go after the fact that this shouldn't be Trump's choice to make and that he's trying to undo the Affordable Care Act amid a pandemic. But heap scorn on the People of Praise, and you'll regret it. Again, this was a column written by Melinda Hennenberger. Returning to the news, Tom Vandenbroek of USA Today reports, Pentagon distances on election questions. President Donald Trump can't expect military aid from the Pentagon if he disputes the election results, according to the military's top officer and the leading Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. Trump has twice in recent days declined to promise a peaceful transition if he loses the November 3rd election. Democrats blasted him for the comments, and some Republican leaders, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have promised an, quote, orderly, end quote, handover of power should former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee, win the election. Army General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, stated in an August 28th letter in response to questions from members of Congress that he views no role for the military in the election. Quote, "The Constitution and laws of the U.S. and the states establish procedures for carrying out elections and for resolving disputes over the outcome of elections," Milley wrote. Quote, "State and federal governments have qualified officials who oversee these processes according to those laws. We are a nation of laws. We follow the rule of law and have done so with regard to past elections and will continue to do so in the future. I do not see the U.S. military as part of this process. This is the responsibility of Congress, the Supreme Court, and components of the executive branch," end quote. On Thursday, Representative Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, told CNN that he had been assured by military leaders that they would disregard illegal orders to interfere in the election. Quote, the military has made clear to me they will not follow an unlawful order, period, Smith said. Smith added that military leaders this summer resisted Trump's call for federal troops to deal with the unrest following the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by police in Minneapolis. But Defense Secretary Mark Esper pushed back against invoking the Insurrection Act that would have allowed active duty troops, some poised in June on the outskirts of Washington, to quell disturbances. Military officials were prepared to defy what was considered an unlawful order to confront protesters, Smith said. Quote, their oath is to the Constitution, much to Donald Trump's chagrin, Smith said. Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island and the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, in a statement Friday challenged his Republican colleagues to rebuke Trump more forcefully. He singled out Trump's disparagement of mail-in ballots. Quote, President Trump is wrong, and Republicans need to do more than just say they support a peaceful transition of power, Reed said. They need to reject Trump's sabotage of the U.S. Postal Service and repeated attacks on free and fair elections. President Trump's game is to cast doubt on the process and therefore the results. It's a cynical move that hurts the country and does serious long-term damage to our democracy. End quote. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.